The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening, everyone. Tonight I thought I would talk about friendship and friendliness. There's one famous quote of the Buddha I'll read it to you. It's Ananda comes to the Buddha, and he kind of enthusiastically, I mean, you get this interesting sense of Ananda when you read the suttas about how much he loved the Dhamma and how much he loved talking to the Buddha about the Dhamma and sharing the Dhamma. And he said, Venerable Sir, it seems to me that half of the holy life is good spiritual friendship, good companionship. And the Buddha responded by saying, don't say that, Ananda. Actually, the entire of the holy life is good friendship and good companionship. And he goes on to say what he means, that basically without good friendship, and by friendship here, I think he means the friendship of a spiritual friend, a spiritual companion. Without a spiritual companionship, we would never find the path. We'd never find the spiritual life. He says, when the Buddha refers to a bhikkhu, he refers to anybody who is seriously engaged in the path. When one has a good friend, a good companion, it is to be expected that she will develop and cultivate the Noble Eightfold Path. So having a good friend, having essentially a sangha, a community of friends to support us, helps us on our path of practice. And there's two sides to the friendship, of course. There is the having the friend, and there is also the being a friend. So I'd like to explore this. This friendship connects us with each other. This spiritual friendship which connects us with each other. The Buddha listed seven qualities of a spiritual friend. And I'd like to read this to you. A friend should be followed when she possesses seven factors. What seven? She gives what is difficult to give, does what is difficult to do, patiently endures what is difficult to endure, reveals her own secrets, keeps one's secrets, does not abandon one in misfortune, does not despise one because of one's loss. So these are qualities to look for in a friend. And the first three, I think, are interesting. They maybe deserve a little bit of exploration. Gives what is difficult to give, does what is difficult to do, and endures what is difficult to endure. The others, I think, we more connect with and understand in a friend. The others, keeping one's secrets, revealing their own secrets, not abandoning one in misfortune. So, being supportive and not despise one because of a loss. Those are all qualities that we immediately connect with and recognize in friendship. These first three maybe are a little harder to understand. And actually, in this text that I have, there's no commentary on what they mean. And so I'm just going to have to tell you what I think they mean, how I understand them. So the first is giving what is difficult to give. I think this maybe refers to a couple of things. One is that when one is a true friend, one gives to one's friend the best of oneself. So one gives the best of one's time, the best of one's qualities. And this may not be so easy at times. So this is the giving of the best of us is what would be a quality of a good spiritual friend. This also may refer to the giving of meditation instruction, the giving of wisdom teachings, which would be understood to be difficult because it is difficult to cultivate oneself to the place where we can give those things. That we really have to meet ourselves, we have to engage fully in the path in order to be in a place to give in that way. Then does what's difficult to do. To me, that one connects directly to the path of practice. This path of practice, of purifying our hearts of greed, of aversion, of delusion, of purifying our conduct, of meeting people with kindness and compassion instead of with frustration or hostility or annoyance. It's not easy to engage in this path of practice. It's not easy to meet ourselves with truth and honesty and acknowledge, yes, I have these qualities and I wish to work to cultivate to abandon these qualities. So that's how I understand a good spiritual friend does what is difficult to do and endures what is difficult to endure. I think of this as also connected because in this path of practice, we meet our minds. And if we're very honest, we meet some very painful things. And patiently enduring, patiently working with our minds over time is what it takes. It's not a matter of simply meeting ourselves with mindfulness once or twice and then everything is okay after that. Over and over again, we need to meet our difficult states. Over and over again, we need to contact our own challenges, our own pains, our own suffering. And through that contact, that gentle meeting, essentially a friendliness with ourselves, we transform. And so through this process, there is a sense of enduring in a way. Enduring not meaning a gritting one's teeth, but kind of a patient endurance, a patient willingness to continue to practice, to continue to engage. So these seven qualities are qualities that we look for in others, but also qualities to cultivate in ourselves so that we can be good friends, so that we can be friends to others. There's another, I'm just reviewing at the beginning here some of the Buddhist teachings on friendship. And he has another teaching, this one particularly for lay people. And what is good friendship? In whatever village or town a person dwells, he associates with householders or their sons, and householders is just basically the Buddhist term for people who are living in the world, not non-monastics. He associates with householders or their sons, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. He converses with them and engages in discussions with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, virtue, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. So this points to some other qualities that are supportive in a friendship. In particular, virtue, wisdom, faith, and generosity. And in particular of those, I find, you know, since friendship is about connectivity, connecting with each other, one of some of the things I'd really like to explore in a little more detail are generosity and virtue, ethical conduct and giving. Because these two are actions that directly connect us with others. And in my own experience in engaging in this practice, they are places where this cultivation of friendship unfolds in the acts of the act of giving, the act of ethical conduct, directly connects us with other people through our actions. So giving, this quality of offering to another, directly connects us with another person. The giver and the receiver are directly connected, especially when the giving is done directly. And the Buddha actually recommended this in terms of giving gifts. He recommended a direct contact because I think it does support this quality of connectivity and of friendship, the opening of the heart to someone. When you think about giving a gift, even if a material gift, even say, you know, when I think about giving a gift, there's a certain amount of, you know, thinking about that person. What is it that they would like or would need or could use? And so there's a connectivity that happens in that contemplation about giving the gift, that we open our hearts to what they might be able to use in their lives. We are connected to them in the actual giving of the gift. There's a teaching, actually, that says if you have an enemy of some kind or somebody who's difficult for you, then one way to help overcome that difficulty is to give the person a gift. And that can be an interesting practice to try. To try that and see what happens if you actually contemplate what somebody who's difficult for you might be able to use, might be able to appreciate as a gift. Then also in terms of connectivity and also in the realm of generosity and giving is the giving of our kindness and our attention. Now, we may not think of that so much as giving, but it is an act of giving to connect with somebody and give them our attention and our kindness. Even in simple ways, we can practice this. You know, we can, in going into a grocery store, consciously choose to see if you can engage in kindness and friendliness with the people that you meet. Maybe smile at people. I mean, the smile is an amazing thing. I've found, you know, if I'm taking a walk, one of my practices when I'm taking a walk is to see if people will make eye contact with me. I mean, I don't try to force it on them, but, you know, if somebody will make eye contact with me, I smile at them. And I'm always amazed, actually. I mean, it strikes me every single time when I smile at somebody, almost always I get a smile in return. And the happiness that results from that lasts for like 30 seconds or a minute or something. I mean, it's amazing how much joy this can bring. I mean, a smile, just that connectivity, that simple connectivity, even with somebody that you don't know, brings joy and happiness into our hearts if you are present and available to experience it. And then there is, of course, the formal practice of kindness, which is consciously turning your mind towards kindness through thoughts, actually, consciously reflecting, bringing people into your mind and consciously directing well-wishing towards that person. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, may you live with ease. This practice begins to incline our hearts towards the kindness, towards this connectivity. Actually, the Pali word for friend is mitta, which is very closely related to the Pali word for kindness, which is metta. So they're very closely connected, the words for friendship and for kindness. So this inclining the mind towards this connectivity, this expressing of wishes of kindness, is in a way of connecting of the heart, a heart-to-heart connection through this expression of well-wishing. Again, it's quite an interesting practice. You know, one place that it's easiest to see the transformation that this can happen is if you pick somebody that you don't know very well, somebody that you can imagine in your mind, you know, maybe somebody that you see at the bank regularly or somebody at the grocery store, some kind of neutral person that you are in contact with but don't have much connection with. If you spend a couple of weeks wishing that person well, see what happens to you the next time after a couple of weeks of doing that. You go in and see that person. How much more connectivity there may be through that simple act of wishing well. So we begin to cultivate friendship through this connectivity. Really, it is about connectivity. This we cultivate not only when we smile at somebody, we cultivate that connection. When we express these wishes of goodwill, we cultivate that connection. And so we are, in a sense, in this way, opening our hearts to being a friend. And in turn, it seems that in that opening of the heart to be a friend, friendship returns to us. Although it's not a demand that we can make in this process. And this is something in the teachings around generosity. The purest kind of giving, the purest kind of offering, the offering of a gift or the offering of kindness, the offering of attention, doesn't demand anything in return. It's really just an opening of the heart. We can also connect through our presence when somebody is suffering or struggling. And this is a beautiful offering, a beautiful gift. Giving of your own time and emotional resources, just actually to even just be present, to just be mindful with somebody who is struggling. This simple presence can be one of the most powerful ways to be a true friend. You know, we often think that if somebody is expressing difficulty of some kind, that we need to somehow offer them something to do, or, you know, oh, well, maybe you need to try this or try this or try this. You know, go on this vacation, or, you know, find another friend, find another boyfriend or another girlfriend, you know. I'll match you up with somebody, you know. We feel like we have to do something when somebody is expressing that a pain in their lives. But look in your own heart when you make that gesture. You know, sometimes it is an act of a wishing to alleviate their suffering, but often it is also a sense of how uncomfortable we are of sitting in that presence of somebody being in pain. And so we try to find ways to fix it because we can't tolerate that feeling. The offering of being someone who can sit in the presence of pain is one of the greatest gifts that we can give, and one of the greatest ways to connect, actually. Just presence, just simple presence can have that quality of connectivity and of kindness. This was really demonstrated to me at one point. I have a friend, and at one point we were spending quite a bit of time together. And one day our conversation turned in this direction where this friend began to reveal to me some deep pain that he'd experienced as a child. And I was very moved, and we just sat there for a while, and you know, he said, you know, well, I don't know what to do here. And I said, well, you don't have to do anything. I'm just willing to sit here with you. And he said, oh, well, in that case, and then he just kind of broke down and just wept. And I just sat there with him, and I was just doing my best to be present, just to be there with him. And a couple of days later, he came back to me, and he said, "What were you doing?" I said, "I was just trying to be there with you." He asked me, "Were you doing metta? Were you sending me kindness?" And I said, "I was just being there with you." So, you know, just that presence, just that willingness to be there was felt on his side as kindness, as love. It was quite a remarkable experience to just be willing to be open to that pain and not have to do anything with it. So another way that we connect with other beings is through our conduct, through ethical conduct, through the intention of non-harming. This also brings in this feeling of connectivity, because we are, in our behavior of non-harming, we are safeguarding others. Now, this is something I think that we need to actually consciously reflect on, because, you know, we go around not harming a lot, and we're not really conscious of that. You know, we you know, refrain from killing our neighbors every day. You know, so this is ethical conduct, you know. Reflect on how your conduct, when you are engaging in non-harming, when you are, you know, not taking that which is not given. The other day, I was, you know, walking out of my kitchen, and, you know, the light was on, and I reached up and I turned off the light, and in that moment I thought, in a way, that's not taking what's not given. You know, it's turning off the light was a way of not taking resources that I didn't need. And in that reflection, I had a moment of a feeling of happiness, you know, to actually connect with how the action of just turning off the light connected me with more beings through not consuming resources. So, you know, I think part of this in terms of looking at how we're connected through non-harming is partly we need to reflect on our goodness, reflect on how we are engaging in ethical conduct really frequently. Our minds tend to highlight those cases where we aren't so helpful, where we do engage in something that's a little harmful, telling a lie to somebody, and we blow those, you know, into large proportion and feel like we're horrible people. But think of all the times that you're not lying. You know, I'm not saying not to acknowledge the times that you do. I mean, it is really helpful to connect with and acknowledge those times. And you know, in the making of amends, that's another form of connectivity, you know, that we go back and, you know, correct our error, our errors in ethical conduct. We connect in that way as well. It's sometimes said that our ethical conduct offers the gift of fearlessness to countless beings. And this is, you know, this is just that if we're engaging in non-harming, then beings do not need to be afraid in our presence. You know, I've seen how this works too, in just simple ways. Again, you know, noticing in the small ways that kind of add up. You know, I've got a practice of, as much as possible, not killing insects in my house. I try to, you know, take them outside or, you know, do whatever I can to find them a new home. And I've found over the years of engaging with this that there's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of a connectivity with life, just life in general, through this practice of not harming other beings through consciously not engaging in killing, even insects. Yesterday morning, I was in my bathroom, and I noticed this little insect crawling on the floor, and it was clearly in death throes. It was, you know, on its back and struggling, and it would flip over, and it would crawl a few steps, and then it would flip back over, and it would, you know, oh, my heart, just seeing this. It was right in the middle of the bathroom floor, and I didn't want to step on it, you know. So I kind of moved it to the side so it could have its death throes in a kind of more safer place. I didn't need to take it outside because I knew it would die soon. But there was something about this process connects us with life. So these practices of giving and of ethical conduct begin to make us more of a good friend to other beings. And yet what we seem to also want is friendship from others. So much of our suffering, I think, is around loneliness and unmet expectations in friendships. We need we seem to have a need for friendship out of this feeling of loneliness, a need, you know, we feel incomplete sometimes if we don't have this connectivity with others. We need to feel needed, we need to feel cared for, we need to feel loved, we need to feel wanted. In order to feel good about ourselves, it seems that we need this. I looked up on the internet today, I was looking up definitions of loneliness, and most of them were like dictionary definitions, you know, the absence of other people, you know, the quality of being alone. And then I stumbled into this psychological definition, which I really think captures what we mean by loneliness. This is from two psychologists from the University of Chicago. The most broadly accepted definition of loneliness is the distress that results from discrepancies between ideal and perceived social relationships. This so-called cognitive discrepancy perspective makes it clear that loneliness is not synonymous with being alone, nor does being with others guarantee protection from feelings of loneliness. Rather, loneliness is the distressing feeling that occurs when one's social relationships are perceived as being less satisfying than what is desired. That resonated for me. I mean, that struck me as true. That it is in the it's in our own desire or what we project or wish from others that we're not getting that we feel loneliness. So from a practice perspective, this is something we can work with. This looking at this discrepancy between what we want and what is here. This is the basics of suffering. Things as they are, not liking things as they are. This friendship, not quite what I want. I want more of them. I want less of them. I want more intimacy. I want more time. I want less this kind of discussion, more that kind of discussion. So from a practice perspective, the idea isn't to try to change people and make them be what we want them to be. Not possible, actually. But we can look at ourselves. Or even, it's not from the practice perspective, it's not even necessarily to just keep trying on people to find that perfect fit. You know, maybe out there is my perfect soulmate. I think there are a few rare people that find such a person. But I think they're in the minority. So the practice is to look at what it is that we want, to turn towards our own desires and wishes, and begin to look at the reality of the situation. Begin to look at our own contribution to our own loneliness. So we, connecting outwardly, I mean, I think a lot of what this is pointing to, at least to me, is that in friendship, in order that, you know, that we not have this feeling of loneliness, or to work with this feeling of loneliness, we connect inwardly. Now, I've found in my own experience that, you know, this feeling of wanting some kind of connection that can't be met, you know, wanting this kind of relationship that isn't out there in the world. Can be shifted by turning to look at our own experience. I'll give you an example from my own life, my own practice. I had fallen in love with this man, and it was clear that he was not interested. It was kind of an unrequited experience for me, you know, it was unrequited love. I had very strong feelings for him, and they didn't go away when it began to be clear. It just got clear that he was not interested, you know. So it's like, okay, so I backed off of, you know, any kind of impetus in that direction. But I still felt all of these feelings for him, and initially there was this sense of, this is not appropriate. I'm not supposed to be feeling these feelings. And so I was kind of like shutting them off or blocking them or trying to repress them somehow. And one day, I remember, I was in my room and I was feeling the struggle around this, you know, this perceived discrepancy. This discrepancy between what my feelings were and what his feelings were. And I was feeling the struggle around it. And at some point there was this interesting kind of switch in my mind that just was like, well, what are you afraid of? Why are you afraid of feeling these feelings? And in that moment, my heart kind of opened to a feeling of kindness and love to him. Just this pure, unadulterated metta feeling of loving kindness out to him. It needed nothing in return. It was just this beautiful feeling of, oh, I really hope that you're happy. I hope that you can find true happiness in your life. And it was just this feeling pouring out of me. And to my surprise, what I felt, what occurred in my mind was, this is the feeling that I've been looking for. It didn't need anything back. I mean, it shocked me in a way that all of this time I had been searching for something out in the world in relationship, hoping to get something back from somebody. And the feeling that I was looking for was an expression outwards of that love. That moment really transformed my whole experience around loneliness. I don't recall, I'm sure I've been lonely since then, but it is really not, it doesn't happen very much anymore. That moment really shifted my perspective around relationship and loneliness and friendship. So this this is kind of like what I realized is this is befriending myself to have this outer quality of love going out. This really expresses the kind of reciprocal nature of this quality of metta, of love, of friendship. That as we cultivate that quality in ourselves, we ourselves are filled up. It's quite beautiful. So it's just this reciprocal relationship. As we cultivate ourselves, we are more available to be friends with others, and in turn, our own hearts are more at peace and at ease. There's this teaching that the Buddha says, protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And I think this, we could put love in there too. Loving oneself, one loves others. Loving others, one loves oneself. So we connect to our experience through mindfulness, through awareness of everything that happens in our experience. And this is really, you know, one definition of this practice of awareness, of mindfulness, is that it is the act of befriending ourselves to bring this kind of attention, this mindful attention has a quality of bringing along a non-judgmental, non-reactive awareness. And I think that's what my friend felt when I was just trying to be present for him. He felt that non-reactivity, that non-judgment. And it is experienced as kindness and as love. And we can turn that to ourselves. We can be our own friend and meet our own suffering. Don't underestimate the power of that mindful attention. So we cultivate connectivity with others, which brings along some of these qualities of friendliness and friendship. Cultivate giving, we cultivate ethical conduct, we cultivate mindful attention. And all of these slowly work on our hearts, open our hearts. And this opening of our hearts allows us to connect more fully with others, be more available as a friend, allows us to be more receptive to being a friend and having friends. And also seems to heal this deep loneliness. It can begin to heal this deep loneliness, this feeling of needing something that we cannot find. So those are some of my thoughts on friendship and friendliness. Are there any thoughts or comments or questions? Okay.
You were talking about what loneliness means, and I was thinking, some time ago I read a book by a psychiatrist named Shapiro, and the title of the book always has stayed with me, and it's called Lost in Familiar Places. Mm-hmm. And as you were talking, I found myself going back to that saying, because I think that the whole idea of being alienated from someone or not being able to relate to that person or to that situation is sort of almost lacking a map, you know, lacking an ability to make that connection. So anyway, I just thought of that saying.
Yeah, and you know, I think the map, we can find that map through the willingness to turn towards the feeling of lost. You know, it's a paradox. We find the map through being willing to feel lost. And the suffering of that. Thank you. Yeah, in the back.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. I was wondering if you can explore more about bringing friendship into difficult situations. And it's easy to think about it in normal situations or a beautiful, peaceful place like here. But I don't know, if you go in the past, let's say if you were a warrior, if your task was to draw your sword and kill somebody, how do you bring friendship to that? And it happens in our daily lives, it's just verbal. It doesn't manifest in that kind of violence, but how do you bring friendship to violence, and how can you be violent and be a friend?
Well, the teaching, you know, around violence is that we begin to transform our hearts around the need to be violent. That violence is generally coming out of some unhelpful energies in our minds coming out of greed or aversion. You know, the task of being a soldier, I'm going to put that one aside for the moment. You know, if you're at work and you've got a kind of a relationship with this working person where there's a lot of stress and difficulty, and this person perhaps has a view or an opinion of you that makes you feel like, you know, how do I communicate with this person? You know, I really feel like I need to shake them up in order to get through to them. You know, that is worth exploring in your own heart. Is there a way to connect or to communicate without causing harm? You know, is there a way to explore, even if you don't necessarily feel it in the moment, is there a way to explore a behavior that might have some kindness in it? You know, a kinder way to speak, a kinder way to act. To just begin to cultivate that quality, you know, that we often feel so defensive when somebody attacks us. That defensiveness is coming partly because we feel, you know, that either that wasn't, you know, that was, you know, something that you didn't want to hear or didn't want to have somebody say to you, or you're having a sense that you're being dismissed. And, you know, there's something inside of you that is kind of rearing up and struggling with that, whatever that person has said. And so that's an internal thing, actually. It doesn't have to be that we have that response. It's kind of an optional response when we respond in that kind of a violent way or, you know, kind of a harsh way. And so it's beginning to recognize that harshness is optional, and can we kind of reorient and try to find a way to communicate that doesn't bring in that harshness. And now, this doesn't go quite as far as the soldiers in battle, but I'm going to tell a story from Sharon Salzberg, who at one point was in India and in a rickshaw, and some thug, she was, you know, with another person in the rickshaw, and some thug came up and was trying to drag her out of the rickshaw, and you know, she was very distressed and, you know, trying to, you know, push the attacker off without causing him harm. And she went back to her teacher and he said, she told the story to him, and he said, "Well, did you have your umbrella with you?" And she said, "Yes, I did." And he said, "Well, what you should have done is, with all the loving kindness you could find in your heart, hit him with your umbrella." You know, so this points to the taking of action. You know, it's like, you know, we don't just let people do things to us. If somebody is attacking us, you know, we can try to stop them. And some of that stopping, in a way, you know, stopping somebody from harming somebody is an act of kindness. You know, so, you know, and to the other person. It's not only an act of kindness to yourself, it's an act of kindness to the other person to stop them from harming you. So, so, you know, there can be that energy as well, you know, that we don't have to just, like, sit back and let things roll over us, but to take action with as much of that connection to kindness and compassion as you can.
Thank you. So I'm going to, if I may, another situation where it's kind of on the line and gray. So before coming here, I got taken by this situation as a politician or a group of politicians in a city that want to do something to help solve an issue. And some people of the community, they just don't see the world through their lens.
Yes.
So, you know, it's like, who do you who do you go and do service for? I can see how the politicians see it, and I can see how the community sees it. Who do I side with? How do I bring friendship between? They all want to help, but they don't see each other, and there's so much conflict and hate. And whatever side I align myself with, I can kind of see myself then going into the negative about the other side.
Is it possible to try to bridge the divide through, you know, education in a way? You know, it's like it's partly we all have different perspectives. And yes, you know, the more open our minds get, the more open our hearts get, the more we can actually see from different perspectives. So that we don't have to close our heart to one perspective just because we hold this perspective. And it really is about closing the heart, you know. It's like you can actually feel completely like that perspective is not helpful, and yet it's not closing your heart to the people. You know, it's kind of like acknowledging, you know, those perspectives are not helpful perhaps for this situation. But we don't have to close our hearts to the people. And we can try to bridge the connection, bridge the divide through continuing to, you know, I could see you kind of in a mediator role almost, you know, kind of in the middle. A hard place to be, a very hard place to be. But, you know, that we need that kind of person to be able to see multiple perspectives, to bridge the divide.
This holding of the paradoxes and then acting from that space.
It is a challenge, yeah. I mean, but the key is to keep your heart open. I mean, that's the main teaching, is to keep the heart open. It's not necessarily to say, well, I believe everybody, because we can't. I mean, they're contradictory perspectives. But to keep your heart open to the people. It's kind of like with somebody that's done something that's harmed you. You know, the forgiveness for that person isn't about forgiving the action. It's not saying that was okay that you did that thing. It's about letting go of the contraction towards that person.
Thank you so much.
We have time for another, if there's another comment.
I think just what you just said kind of got to what I was thinking about being maybe wronged by somebody and how, you know, needing to forgive them, but how do you get there? I mean,
yeah.
How do you get to that point where you can open your heart and in loving them and sending that to them?
Forgiveness practice, I mean, there's actually a formal practice of forgiveness. And, you know, when somebody has harmed you, well, I'll just describe briefly the practice itself, because I think it actually is an interesting piece of this puzzle of friendship, the piece of forgiveness. So in the formal practice of forgiveness, it's kind of three parts. First, we imagine or envision those persons that we have harmed, and we ask for forgiveness for having harmed them. Then the next one is offering forgiveness to ourselves for actions that we have done to harm ourselves. And the third is asking or is offering forgiveness to those who have harmed us. And that one is generally the most difficult. There's a formal phrases, you know, the formal phrases are something like, for any actions I have done, knowingly or unknowingly, that have caused you harm, I ask for your forgiveness. For any actions that I have done, knowingly or unknowingly, that have caused myself harm, I forgive myself. And then the third one, the phrase is, for any ways that you have harmed me, knowingly or unknowingly, I freely forgive you. Now that phrase for people often is tantamount to a lie when they're saying it, you know, because there isn't the feeling of being able to forgive. And so there's a couple of other options as kind of stepping stones. And one is to say, I hope to be able to forgive you someday. You know, to just open your heart in that direction. You know, I someday be able to forgive you. Or a kind of an intermediate might be, I forgive you as much as I can right now. You know, I forgive you as much as I'm able at this moment. Just as a way, again, of opening the heart. But to even just express, may I someday be able to forgive you. You know, that opens the possibility of connection. And it is basically about not closing your heart to that person. It's not about somehow saying or feeling or thinking that what they did was no problem, fine. You know, that's not what we're talking about here. It may be that the act is unforgivable. The person is forgivable. So, may you find ways to connect with others in friendship. May you find ways to connect with yourself in friendship. And may you open your heart to the friendship that is inside of you and can make you feel happiness. Thank you for your attention.